Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott.
And I am Ben. We are here with Noel, the mover, Brown. That was not the most creative nickname.
The mover and shaker.
Maybe mover and shaker. Yeah, Noel, the mover and shaker, Brown, as always, our super producer. Most importantly, ladies and gentlemen, you are here, which makes this Car Stuff.
That's right. And I think we got a little bit of a disclaimer that we'd like to read before we begin this entire thing, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, regular listeners, as you know, Scott and I recently did a three-part podcast on highway safety films, which we thought would be an interesting bit of history, but turned out to be much, much darker than we had originally imagined.
Absolutely. And you know what? There's a new twist on that, too, by the way. And we didn't even talk about this before we came in here, but
right.
Someone who sits immediately next to me in the office knows the director director of that that documentary that we were talking about,
yeah.
That entire thing, the Hell's Highway documentary. She's personal friends with that guy. And I believe we may be trying to arrange maybe an interview. I don't know if it's going to be video, if it's going to be audio, what it's going to be. But we can get some even more inside info from that guy if we want.
Yeah, and that's so we're still not done with that story. And we love to speak with this guy. And we hope that we get a chance to connect you with him so you can hear more of the behind the scenes. But after we did this thing and after we learned some very disturbing things about the history of highway safety films, you and I, Scott, had decided, well, let's do something a little bit lighter. Let's do something more like just a normal, regular Car Stuff episode.
Yeah, something not so on the edge, I guess.
Right, right. And so we chose U-Haul, and we thought, well, that's good. That's interesting. A lot of people use U-Haul. It's a gigantic company, like $4 billion or something.
Yeah, huge, huge. It's an enormous North American company all over the United States, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're down into Mexico or not, but it's a big place. 16,000 locations.
Yeah.
It's huge. And what could be so bad about the story of U-Haul, Ben? What could
right.
What could throw a wrench in that plan?
We thought it would be safe. We thought it would be fun. We were wrong.
Yeah, this story is going to take some twists and turns as well, and we didn't expect it at all. We really thought we were just going to be doing a podcast on a truck rental, trailer rental, propane selling type place.
Yeah.
Not the case.
Right. So it may sound like something that initially isn't that fascinating. But stick with us, guys, because it's going to get weird.
Yeah, and you know what? This is the thing. It didn't even come from our minds. We said,
no.
Well, let me choose this from a list that a listener has sent in. Because we often go to our email and we say, well, you know, we're looking for some topics for next week's show. What are we going to do? And I kind of combed through the emails and, you know, the infamous list that I put things on now, the ever-growing potential podcast list that we really do have. And I found one here. It was from April of this year, and it was a guy by the name of Austin Z. And Austin wrote in and said, my name is Austin. I'm a 22-year-old chemistry student at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. I spend a lot of time in the lab, and I listen to your podcast while I'm in there working. It's a great show, by the way. I'm definitely a fan of all cars, and the wide variety that your show covers is really interesting to me. I myself have owned 6 different vehicles, and he listed his vehicles. One of those is a Mazda Miata, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Lowered.
Lowered, that's right. And he says, my dad exposed me to many vehicles as well and how to work on them, mainly on his 1978 Fiat 124 Spider. I've kind of had a laundry list accumulating in my mind of things I've found interesting and other possible show ideas. So he lists, I think he lists 7 ideas here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, just quickly going through them, it's like mile marker signs, bridges, construction vehicles, roadsters, of course, roadsters because of his Miata.
Sure.
and that Fiat.
Yeah.
New tire technology was one. Driving with a trailer was one, which kind of ties in with today's, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one here, this is the one that we went with, believe it or not. Rental companies such as Enterprise or U-Haul. And then he writes, right after that, he says, there's probably not much to say about that, but I think it's interesting how they aren't dealers, but they've grown empires on short-term vehicle leases. And to that comment, when he says there's not really much to say about that, Oh, man. There is a lot to say about this. Yeah. About U-Haul in specific, because I dove into U-Haul, and mm-hmm. Ben did as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we started researching not just the company, because that was the initial goal here. We started looking at, like, well, what services do they provide?
Right.
You know, what do they do now that they did different from the very beginning, like back when they started? I knew it was an old company.
Yeah.
You know, it's been around for decades and decades, and we'll talk about all this stuff as well. But then I found an article titled The U-Haul Tragedy. Mm-hmm. And it's not a U-Haul tragedy about, like, it's not a story about one person who had a bad weekend with a truck.
Or an accident or something.
No, nothing like that. This is about the family that started the U-Haul industry, the company,
mm-hmm.
and what happened to them, the fate that befell this family. It's really a great tale, and we'll get to the founder of the company, patriarch of the family,
yeah,
and what happened there, some of the stuff that he's dealing with his kids
mm-hmm.
and the business, and it gets really complex and it gets really really. Difficult to listen to at times, really. I mean, I would think.
Right.
Maybe that's not the right way to say it, but.
Well, it is surprisingly, violent and contentious. It's a power struggle, really. It's a Game of Thrones kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think you'd find this at some level in most families that have grown an industry up to a $4 billion business.
Right. Like, the DuPont family is a great example because some members of that family, you know, are pretty much American aristocrats. And I'm not gonna tell you the stuff about all the ins and outs of the DuPont family, but you're a Google search away from learning some really disturbing stuff. This family, however, the U-Haul family, as you said, Scott, it all goes back to one guy who began this dynasty, this empire, a fellow named Leonard Samuel Schoen, born in 1916.
Yeah, 1916. And it wasn't until about 1945 that he actually founded this company, this U-Haul company. And he grew up, of course, you can imagine growing mm-hmm. up during the Great Depression.
In the Farm Belt.
In the Farm Belt, that's right. In fact, he was this isn't like the first thing that he tried either.
No.
He was kicked out of med school for giving answers to other students, apparently. That's, I think, his story. I don't know if that's really true or not.
Right.
But he did have a pre-med degree that he received in 1943.
Mm-hmm.
He has naval service in his background, so he's a Navy man. I think he served in a hospital in Seattle. Of course, that goes along with his pre-med degree, right?
Right.
He was discharged in 1945, however, for rheumatic fever.
Yeah, he also, along the way, one of the businesses he started when he was getting his pre-med degree was he ran a chain of beauty parlors and barbershops.
Hmm.
And then, when he was discharged for rheumatic fever, this is the story I heard. So his wife, a lady named Anna Mary Carty, she and he were moving and they needed to rent a truck
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't. They couldn't get a truck. There was not one. It wasn't a matter of the money. It was a matter of availability.
Was it because they were moving from one place to another?
Yes.
Another city
far away. Yeah.
Yeah. A city far away or a state far away.
Uh-huh.
I believe. And that's the problem is that in 1945, when this was happening, you couldn't really rent a truck or trailer in one state and take it to another state. You'd have to bring it back.
Right. So you would have to somehow figure out how to get it back, which would probably mean either taking a car to follow along with you to ride drogue and then have that car follow you back to the place with the truck so you had to ride back, or maybe you could take a train or something. I don't know. Maybe you could hire somebody in your destination city to drive it back there
this
for you.
This is all very problematic, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it really was because, I mean, this predates the time of one-way rentals, and that's really what mm-hmm. we're getting at here is that
mm-hmm.
he found a way to – you know, he said, well, there's a problem here. There's something we gotta fix. I could make a fortune if we did it this way. And we'll talk about the strategies that they used in just a minute.
Yeah.
But I also want to mention just briefly before we go on, he also received a law degree from, Northwestern College of Law in Portland, Oregon
mm-hmm.
in 1955. So this guy, he's got a lot of education background.
He's smart.
He's a smart cookie, this guy. He really is. And so back to 1945, which is 10 years prior to this law degree, but just after he got out of the service.
Right.
He's realizing, he's seeing that a lot of the veterans that are returning from World War II need to move. It's a mobile society at this point. You know, people are wanting to move to the big cities. They're wanting to move out of the country. They're wanting to move into the suburbs.
They want to get that perfect house.
Yeah, they want to move to the shoreline. They want to move inland. They're moving all over the place. And the problem was, as we said, you couldn't rent a truck without having to bring that same stupid truck back to wherever you rented it from.
Right.
So that's really good for local moves, no problem. But once you want to go from, say you want to move from New York to California, what do you do? And how do you handle that? And as you said, Ben, it becomes a very difficult situation to deal with.
So at this time, 45, Leonard Schoen is 29 years old. He's only 29 years old. And he and his wife are living in a town called Ridgefield, and just north of Vancouver. And, this company gets started. They start U-Haul. This is when they found it that year. And the initial investment is $5,000.
$5,000. And the idea is that they're going to build trailers. They're going to build, they start out without no trucks really.
Yeah.
Just trailers. It's a trailer service, you know, rental service. And what they're going to do is they're going to, I guess you could say employ. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but they're going to co-op with, gas station owners in different states. And they'll say, well, we will split the rental cost of this trailer with you if you agree to let them drop it off and have somebody else pick it up from your gas station.
Right, and he made them agents of U-Haul. They would be rental agents.
Yeah, and this whole thing started out in his wife's family owned a garage. And when they say garage, I mean like a mechanic shop.
Right.
Like a machine shop or something like that. So he was able to fabricate these trailers there, building them as many as he can for $5,000 initially, and then just keep building them based on how much money he was bringing in from the rental of that initial $5,000 investment. And I think it was so smart of him, Ben, to decide to go with gas station owners rather as these partners, because when you look at any town, I mean any place you look in a busy city, there's a gas station on every corner. You've got the opportunity for maybe 100 different dealers, but you only need a couple, really. He only needed one in each big city, really.
And another thing to consider about gas stations, not just big cities, but they're the most likely thing for you to find in any town.
Yeah.
Anywhere, right? Churches, gas stations.
And think about this. Okay, so it's 1945, and, you know, all he really has to do is just get, and this is brand new, and it's a great service. And people will buy into this no matter what. So all he has to really do is get one location in each state going. That's really all he needs. That would be the goal, I guess. I know he wanted more, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be the goal, is so that, you know, once you do move to, let's say here in Georgia, you move down to, Valdosta, which is like the very southern end of Georgia. But let's say that the gas station that's the partner is here in Atlanta.
Yeah.
It's going to be, you know, 5 or 6 hours to drive one way. But you know what? That sure does beat having to return it to the state that you rented it from. Mm-hmm. So people wouldn't really mind, like, okay, it's going to take me another day, half day there and half day back to return this trailer, but it's so worth it because I was able to move myself and save the expense of having a moving company take me and my family and all of our stuff across the country.
Yeah, and they did something that's very smart, and it's difficult for a lot of families to do, which is that the Schoen family, the wife and the husband, worked more than 15 hours a day, and they put all of the profits back into the company. These are very frugal, thrifty people. And somehow along the way, they had like 6 kids.
Yeah, not just 6, though.
Oh, wait, with Anna Mary Carty.
Okay, I'm glad you put an asterisk on that, because here's the scoop on Leonard and his wives and his children, because I think this is fascinating. He ended up being married 5 times over, until he passed away. We'll talk about that too. But his first wife, unfortunately, Anna Carty, she passed away. He divorced 3 wives after that, and then he was married to number 5 when he passed away. Her name is Carol Schoen.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, as you said, Ben, he had 6 children with his first wife. He had 5 children with the second wife. He had 1 child with his third wife, and then he had 1 adopted child, I believe, with his 5th wife. So the 4th wife, there was no children involved, or no extra children involved.
Mm-hmm.
A total, if you count the adopted child, that means 13. He had 12 birth children, 1 adopted. So 13 children in all that this guy had over his life with 5 wives.
And prolific, not just with, if you think he's prolific with the kids, you should see You should see his output with trucks because.
Man.
Do you want to
look
take
at it? No, no, that's funny. That's a funny segue.
Well, yeah, it's true though. By 1955, just 10 years later, this is one of the most fascinating things. They went from zero to what? 10,000?
Yeah.
Trailers?
10,000 U-Haul trailers were on the roads as of 1955. And that's just 10 years. So that's the same year that he's getting his law degree, by the way.
Uh-huh.
This is a busy guy. I mean, he's really putting everything he's got into this business, into this industry, into making this whole thing work. And, you know, of course, his wife was right there at his side the whole time, you know, Anna Carty, the first
right.
wife, busy with the six kids, I'm sure.
Oh.
But man, they were really putting everything they had back into the business because he knew that, you know, 10,000 trailers is just the start of this whole thing. It's, you know, I don't know how many, retail locations they had, or not retail, but, how many partners they had at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But it did eventually grow. As I said, you know, once we get to, I think modern day, like right now, there's something like 16,000 outlets that you can return U-Haul
right.
equipment to.
Not trailers, outlets.
Outlets, yeah, like where you can, and I think that's the right term.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, a place in the corner where you can pick up and return U-Haul trailers. It's not always a U-Haul location. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's a gas station, as it was in the beginning.
And the business was based in Portland until a little bit more than 10 years after that. They moved to Phoenix, I believe. Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, that's right. So it started, I mean, it was actually founded in Ridgefield, Washington, as you mentioned before, when he was 29. And you said it moved to Portland, then to Phoenix. And that's where it is right now. It's still in Phoenix because this company is still around and it's still run by the Schoen family.
Mm-hmm.
The founder, of course, was Leonard Schoen. The chairman and CEO is a guy named Joe Schoen. There's also a vice president. His name is Mark Schoen. So, you know, the Mark and Joe are kind of at the top still. And I think I believe they own 40% of the company at this point. And this company has been, as we said, has been around since 1945. So it's an older company. It is again valued at $4.02 billion. And that was in 2006. It may have gone up, may have gone down a little bit, but it's a ballpark of where we're talking. It's a huge, huge industry. The founder, Leonard Schoen, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There's the chairman and CEO, which his name is Joe Schoen, and then the vice president, who is Mark Schoen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just two of the 13 children that he had.
Yeah, two of his kids. They launched a takeover of the business in 86.
Here's where it gets interesting. I guess it. I mean, maybe it's already been interesting to this point, you know, the development of the company and everything, but this is where it takes a decided twist because those two, Joe and Mark,
mm-hmm.
launch a takeover of their father's company in, what do you say, 1986?
Yes, sir.
And I think that the way this all plays out is that there's an older son, and what was his name? Was it Sam?
Sam
Schoen. Now, you would think that Sam Schoen, being the oldest son, would be the one who, and the oldest child of all. You know, he's not just the oldest male. He's the oldest child. I think he was being groomed by his dad to take over the company.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's kind of the story. That
was sort of the idea. But also, okay, so we're getting to the part where the crazy stuff we mentioned earlier is going to happen. I just want to give a few statistics before we get into it.
Sure.
Is that cool?
Yeah.
All right. So why is this company such a big deal? Well, they've got a built-in market. One in five people move each year. According to U-Haul themselves, the average person moves 11 times in their life.
You're saying that 20% of people move, all people, or here in the United States or North America, move every year?
Yeah, apparently.
No
20%.
Kidding. That's a huge number.
I think this might be a little bit optimistic for U-Haul's business,
yeah.
But anyway, as you know, most people who move do it themselves,
sure.
Right? More than half. Here's an interesting thing I didn't know. It's about the best time to move. 45% of all moves occur between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
I didn't know that.
I did not either.
Hmm.
I typically, just for some bad luck, end up moving in summer, which for those of you who have ever been to the south of the U.S., going outside and doing anything during summer is usually just a foolish idea.
I'll be honest. I don't even like walking to my car from my front door. It's a difficult walk.
And you open the door and it's like you're getting slapped in the face with a rubber blanket.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the humidity, I mean, it's just unbelievable. So moving at that time of year is nearly impossible, but you're saying that's when it ends up for me.
Yeah. I rolled the dice and I got bad moves.
Oh man.
Yeah.
That is bad news.
But all that to be said, I just wanted to get some of that out there. Scott, do you think we should talk a little bit more about U-Haul as a company before we go into the juicy stuff?
Yeah, I think we definitely should, because there's definitely some juicy stuff coming up. Mm-hmm. But let's talk just a moment about some of the stuff they offer, because I was looking at the site. Mm-hmm. And I was actually kind of impressed by what they offer. I had a very narrow view of what they had. And I know that they do the trailer hitches. You know, they install a lot of trailer hitches, because I always see a lineup of people at those locations waiting for, you know, whether it's putting a hitch on a minivan,
uh-huh,
or even like some small cars I've seen there. But it's usually trucks, you know, smaller trucks that people are trying to, you know, throw a hitch on so they can tow the boat to the lake or whatever.
Sure.
Right. Or a U-Haul trailer, of course, because they're going to haul it across the country. Another thing that makes sense is they have their own storage units, like their self-storage areas,
mm-hmm,
which kind of, I understand that. I mean, that, you know, it can offer like a, almost like as a package deal, you know, you can move it to there and you can use one of our trucks to haul it to wherever you have to go, et cetera. I get it. Moving supplies, we all know that. I mean, they have all the packing supplies and covers and tape and boxes and all that, mm-hmm, stuff. I mean, that's not a big surprise.
No.
There's about three here that I was actually kind of surprised by, though. They have something that is akin to the, and you can't really call it this, and I'll tell you why, but it's sort of like the pods idea. And it's actually called the U-Box Moving Containers. And there's a reason you can't call it that, because I think there was a lawsuit from the pods company, cause they compared them to pods you've got to look up the details of the lawsuit, but, do not call them pods, but they're like pods, again, called the U-Box Moving Containers. Same idea, really. Propane. I didn't know that they sold propane.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know why I hadn't thought about this, but, you know, you can drive in and have yours refilled. They also, you know, sell the tanks and everything. And if you've got an RV and, mm-hmm, you have to fill it up before you go across, you know, out to,
perfect,
Yellowstone or wherever, sure, you're going to go, get it filled up there. That's another thing. And this is maybe the most surprising to me. And we'll move on after this one. I mean, we can talk about truck sizes and stuff, because that's important too.
Yes.
Moving labor. They offer moving labor now, and this is an interesting idea.
And I'll
tell you why, because U-Haul traditionally has been about it's right there in the name, U-Haul.
Yeah.
You haul it yourself, you pack it yourself, you know, whether that involves having some friends come over and you buy them a pizza and some beer and you make a day of it or a weekend of it. That's what most people do. Now they offer their own service. You can rent moving labor along with it. So if you don't have, you know, five friends that are willing to help you move that giant, China cabinet or whatever it is that, you know, is a backbreaker. You can have these people help you out, and you still get the benefit of renting a lower cost truck,
uh-huh,
and all the equipment that you'd have to get. You're in charge of like all the blankets and all that stuff, but you can get somebody to help you load, unload, even packing and unpacking if you want to. And I think that's pretty, it's pretty remarkable that they've gone to that, because it's like, it's one step away from being a full service move, but you're still getting the discount on the truck.
Right, yeah. And also, I will say another thing that's interesting, and it might not occur to some people. It didn't occur to me until we started looking into this episode. U-Haul can also use its customer data to make predictions that are pretty accurate.
Really?
Yeah, like what is the fastest growing city? U-Haul is one of the groups that will have a very good knowledge of that.
So it's pretty smart.
Yeah.
It'd be a great place to go to get that kind of information.
Where's the brain drain, you know,
mm-hmm,
and what is the most popular maybe neighborhood to move into? Things like that. They can do stuff by zip code.
It's all valuable info.
I see press releases about this stuff. Like, in April 2014, about a year ago, U-Haul ranked Dallas as the top growth city in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably, I don't know if that still holds true.
Well,
now.
I don't know. Cause I mean, I think prior to that, wasn't it Las Vegas? I think Las Vegas was spreading or it was growing at such an incredible rate. And I don't know if the numbers come from U-Haul or where they come from really. But
right.
Probably a you know, conglomerate of all this information.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that they were gaining, like they had a number too. It was like, we're gaining 1200 people a day or something crazy like that. It was a lot of people moving there. And now Dallas is the newest one, apparently.
Yeah.
Or at least at the time.
It was
at
2013.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they're selling this data to different places, but there is a predictive power just because, again, so many people in the States, at least, use U-Haul.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not going to change anytime soon.
Oh, no. And, you know, they've branched or they've moved from doing just trailers now, too.
Right.
So, of course, we all know that they have the U-Haul trucks, the rental trucks, and they range in size from pickup trucks to a 26-foot truck that you can rent, a box truck, everything in between. And they've got a lot of cool features in them, you know, things that make it easy for just about anybody to just jump in this truck and use it, really. I mean, automatic transmissions, they all use gasoline power. They're not diesel or anything like that.
Yeah, but they're still trucks, which we should talk about at some point.
Yeah, we really should. You know what? I'm going to save – let's save that for the end, because I've got a question that I think maybe a lot of people have.
Okay.
About these types of services that rent these trucks. And I think that everybody can kind of relate to this in one way or another. Either you've used the service or you've just witnessed some of this stuff going on.
Yeah. There are different sizes of trucks.
Yeah. And yeah, all the different sizes. Yeah. Okay. So two more quick things and then we'll go back to, how about then we get to, some other stuff.
Okay.
A lot of people don't know that they sell their used trucks and used equipment. So sometimes you can find, everything from, you know, some of the smaller equipment they rent, like parts washers and things like that. I know I've seen, but old used trucks you can buy. You know, they're reconditioned in some way. They're well maintained. They say, I don't know. You know, here's the thing about this.
What's that?
I feel kind of the same way about renting a used U-Haul truck as I would about buying a rental car. I don't know. A lot of them have been put through some pretty rough miles, and you know, they're not treated as if somebody had bought it new and needed to keep it alive and running for 10 years.
They don't get the same investment of TLC.
Yeah. I mean, my comment on this is that used trucks for sale at a U-Haul lot, sure you could, but would you?
Or should you?
Maybe that's a better way to say it. And then the last thing, and then we'll get on to some of the better stuff, I promise. But
this is good stuff.
They have a U-Haul car share service now. And I had no idea until we started looking into this.
Similar to Zipcar, huh?
It is a subsidiary of U-Haul, and it's similar to that, you're right, but it's a completely separate thing. It's got its own website, it's got its own information. You can look up that info if you want, see if it's in your city. I believe it's not in Atlanta right now, because I did try to look up Atlanta, Georgia, to see where a U-Haul car share location was, but I had no idea that they were doing car sharing. And it's a pretty radical idea for a company like this, because I understand it's a vehicle rental, but it's not in the same realm of moving cargo or moving things, moving houses, people.
Right, yeah.
Well, okay, it is moving people, but that's it.
But it makes sense, because so many different businesses are trying to get into that space, or whether they're branching out or whether they're an entirely new thing. The idea of – now, I'm not going to go on a rant about – my problems with shifting from an ownership society to a service society, but I think it's good to own the things you buy.
Yeah.
Before I go any further, you guys, listeners, I'm sure Scott is tired of hearing me go off on these rants. So I'll save the time. But if you would like to hear more about my problems with ownership versus service societies, feel free to send us an email. I will answer it.
Be ready.
Be ready for the response. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
But we are moving on and moving back, rather, to some of the stuff we alluded to earlier. As we said, all was not well in the Schoen family. And now, as we like to say on some of our other shows, here's where it gets crazy.
Yeah, this is the twist in the story, I would guess, right, Ben? Because this is the twist that I didn't expect it to take. I mean, it really, you would think, you'd look at a company like that and you wouldn't realize how, I guess maybe the instability that's going on within the walls of the headquarters.
Right.
And it's all family driven stuff. I mean, this is crazy, Ben. I mean, okay. So where do we even start on this? I mean,
well, let's start just to make sure everybody knows the family. Okay. You heard us say that over the course of his life, Leonard Schoen had been married 5 times.
Yeah.
His first wife, they didn't divorce. Tragically, she passed away of a congenital heart defect. Mm-hmm. And eventually he remarried, and that is, his second wife is the one he had, 5 kids with?
He did.
Okay. So by this point, just by his second wife, they've got 11 children.
Yeah, that is very stressful, I would think.
And the eldest of those children are, of course, from the first wife, and he is grooming some for the business. They're all involved somehow in the business.
Sure. However, that oldest son, I'm sure that Leonard was grooming Sam, the oldest son, to take over the business at some point. You know, not then, but just really giving him, showing him the ways.
Give him the keys to the kingdom eventually.
Yeah,
right?
And that means that the younger sons, and there's a few daughters mixed in there too, I believe.
Right.
The younger sons and daughters were all seeing what's going on, and they're getting a little bit jealous, you know, because, well, here's he's going to be the head of this amazing industry, this billion-dollar industry. So there's that family jealousy that goes on, even though they all likely have a part in this whole thing. I mean, they're going to play a role. It's just they wanted to be the top.
So here, yeah, right. It goes back to the idea of comparative happiness. Very interesting psychological thing. Short tangent, but if it's okay with you, I'm going to chase the rabbit hole for a second.
Of course, go.
All right. So there's an interesting thing that happens about how people define happiness. It's not so much in absolute terms of what you have as it is in relative terms of what you have in comparison to other people, which is the reason why someone who, if we're talking about income, let's say someone makes $15,000 and everyone they work with, everyone else makes $12,000, then they're going to be happier than someone who makes $156,000 in a place where everybody else makes $157,000. It's not an absolute term thing. So in this case, we can see in a way, and I haven't talked to the Schoen family. I don't have evidence of this, but I can see in a way how it would really grind your gears. Even if you're already one of the top people at a gigantic family-owned company, I can see how you would still be livid that there would be someone else above you.
Yeah, so you want to be the big fish in the small pond.
You want to be able to make the decisions.
Yeah, you want to be the one that they go to all the time. I understand that. I get it.
Yeah, and this came to a head, as we said, in the 1980s, Leonard Schoen started giving his stock to his children. He gave away all but what, Scott, 2% maybe?
Yeah, 2%.
He kept 2%. And several of his kids, now you'll hear in different stories, people will just say it was only Joe and Mark Schoen, but they kind of led a rebellion, you know. They kicked their dad out as the president and chairman. They took away his retirement benefits.
Oh, my gosh.
Which to me means it had to be personal.
Yeah, it's personal.
It's not
definitely personal. What do they call that? A crime of passion almost. Not really that. I don't know if you can call it that. That's more violence, really.
But it sounds like there's something vindictive.
I know that that's usually when something violent happens. It's overkill, I guess. But the idea was that they didn't need to do that. They went that extra step to do that intentionally to cause harm to their father. And that's terrible. It's tragic. I mean, this whole thing, this what you're talking about, Ben, this sparks a family feud, a Schoen family feud.
For sure.
Happens. And I mean, it's got all the elements here that you would want in a true crime story, really, because there's violence and even murder at some point, as we're going to get to. And so, the thing is, and I've read this somewhere. I'm going to read this out of this article. It's called U-Haul Tragedy by Tom Fitzpatrick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's an article that was written in 1994, so a long time ago. We're talking 21 years ago at this point. I'll quote from this. He says, "The Schoen family feud is complex and twisted. There is so much intra-family violence, it could be the basis of a Eugene O'Neill tragedy.
true.
Scattered throughout the family history are totally bizarre acts, threats of violence, and a couple of brutal beatings that Schoen's sons administered to each other in full view of their father. And finally, there was the murder of the old man's favorite daughter-in-law. So guess who was murdered? Do you know?
Who was murdered?
Sam Schoen's wife. Mm-hmm. So his favorite daughter-in-law, you know, according to this article, you know, Leonard's favorite daughter-in-law, was the wife of Sam Schoen, which is his oldest son, the one he was grooming for the business. So there's this intentional strike at this woman. Now, here's the thing. He has proposed, or he at the time said, I know who did this. It's a murder for hire scenario by my sons, what are the names? Tom and, Joe and Mark Schoen. He says, I know who it is. And he's outright saying this out to the media, to the public, that, you know, he thinks his sons are involved in this murder somehow. So, you know, this has got to be just shaking to the core for, Sam. You know, like, he's got to be thinking like, well, Jesus, this is a hit that's put on my wife. They're coming for me next. And this all happened, This all happened in Telluride, Colorado, back in 1990, I believe. So it's 4 years prior to this article being written. And just so that we get this all straight right now, because, you know, once we say this, we got to kind of wrap it up. In 1994, right as this article was being written, I believe that the case was kind of put to rest, and that in Montrose, Colorado, an ex-con by the name of Frank Marquise admitted that he fatally shot Miss Eva Schoen, who is the wife of Sam Schoen, of course, the oldest son. And it was not any kind of murder for hire thing. It was he just did this on his own. It was his own act. And that the Schoen brothers were not involved in any way. But the Schoen brothers then, you know, their father has called them out for this thing. They said, you know, he said specifically, I think they were involved in some way. You need to investigate this. He's pointing investigators to try to get them to look into it.
Yeah.
And that becomes a problem for them. You know, they're now at the top of the business, of course.
Right.
But it becomes a problem for them because here they are, these heads of this, this business, and they're being investigated for murder for hire, rather. And I don't know what you would call this exactly, but, it's damning to them in the press and the news, and it's, as far as the way it affects the company and their bottom line.
Right. We want to be careful with how we talk about this, because what we are looking at is just completely publicly available information. Sure, this is one of those iceberg stories. That's what I like to call them.
Yeah.
Because there's a bunch of stuff under the surface that we don't know. People are beating each other in front of their dad.
Yeah, and in front of like other shareholders at the, right. You know, they're beating, these two brothers are getting in fist fights, you know, physical fist fights at these corporate meetings and, you know, in front of their father. And it's just, it's not a good scenario. The whole company is imploding really at this point.
Yes.
And because of all this turmoil that's going on in the family. And last thing on this really that I need to point out is that there's another little angle to this. And I wonder if anybody has thought about this much, but the guy that confessed, he's an ex-con named Frank Marquis. I mean, did he accept a payoff to say that he did it? I mean,
right.
There's always that angle too. I mean, that's the kind of twist that you'll hear in a true crime book.
Yeah.
So I wonder, I'm not saying that happened in this case in any way, but I wonder looking back, did he implicate himself into this when he really wasn't involved in it?
Well, that's a great question. That's happened before. I just want to, clarify some of the stuff we talked about, because you can find, there's an LA Times interview with, Joseph Schoen. And in this account, Leonard resigned. He wasn't tossed out.
Mm.
Interesting is a word. So then the family begins suing and counter suing, right? And eventually I think it's because of the series of counter suits that the health and retirement benefits are, canceled. And he also blocked other family members who weren't on his side of the war from cashing out.
Yep.
Eventually the father and several of the kids who were loyal to him, successfully arranged a countersuit, right?
Yes, that's right. And in 1994, when this article was being written, this U-Haul tragedy article, a recent court verdict, was awarded to Leonard and, his family, the remaining loyal sons and daughters, sons and daughters, a $1.4 billion judgment against his two sons and the company, against U-Haul.
Yeah.
So that's a huge settlement, but I wonder how much of that really actually went back and forth. How much was given to Leonard and his family?
Oh, well, we have the number on that, right?
We do.
Yeah, because it was later reduced, to about $460 million with punitive damages of $7
million. Wait a minute. So they knocked $1 billion off of this judgment?
Pretty much.
This verdict? Holy cow, that's a huge cut in that. But anyway, still, that's a lot of money, okay? So for the Schoen family, for the remaining loyal children and Leonard, and his wife, I guess, it would be Carol, right? The
mm-hmm.
one who's still surviving.
Right.
$486 million plus what was the other amount?
$7 million punitive damages.
Okay. Not bad.
Well, we've got an update on that too,
oh,
by the way,
because okay.
the legal battles continue.
All right.
And we've got a quotation from Joe Schoen here where he said the legal sparring continues on a lower level, but he's put the enmity behind him. He said, I'm quoting from LA Times here, he described his estranged siblings as people I once knew. We all have people like that. This company has made them 100 millionaires, and they're out living lives of the rich and famous. And two of his brothers, Joe was the third kid, two of his brothers stay with the same place or stay with the company. I've got an update from 2012, where the Court of Appeals ruled that Sam was not guilty of libel. I was going to say libel for libel.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing is that, you know, when all this was happening too, back in 94, that libel suit was still pending against Mr. Schoen, against
yes.
Leonard, because of course he had intimated that his sons, you know, Mark and Joe were responsible for the crime, for the murder.
Right.
And you can't do that. You can't just come right out and say that. And that's what I was trying to get at before, but libel is, I guess, the term, the legal term.
Well, also Sam said that he was getting set up because one of the brothers, Mark Schoen, had U-Haul investigate the murder in a way that was supposed to stitch Sam Schoen to it.
No kidding.
Like assuming that Sam Schoen was the killer.
You know what? That's the thing is I bet, of course, we know how this works out. Usually they go to the spouse immediately.
Yeah.
That's the first suspect in all these cases where one spouse is murdered. So, yeah, it does make sense. And they then tried to, again, they intimated that that might be what's going on, that they were trying to implicate him.
Right, yeah.
That. Yeah, I can see how all this is all very, very dirty.
Yeah.
You can see exactly what's going on. I mean, it's extremely possible that, you know, Frank Marquis actually did fatally shoot, you know, Eva Schoen.
Yeah.
And that he, you know, but did he act alone? Was he hired by somebody? And then later, did he take money to, you know, to confess to that, you know, even though it was, you know, years later, a decade later, whatever it was
yeah.
a long time.
And this is not the court saying they believe that members of the Schoen family were involved in the murder. It's not that at all. It's just that the definition of libel is something like saying a thing you know to be untrue to discredit a person.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And he apparently was able to prove to the court that he did not know this to be untrue.
And I guess you could describe Leonard as being kind of a broken man at this point. I mean, he's got a lot of money, but he's troubled.
He's in his 80s.
Yeah,
his family is ruined.
Yeah, from the mid 1980s, his family has fallen apart. He really doesn't, and you know, it's valuable. That's valuable to him. Obviously, he loves big family. You know, that's something that he enjoys. Along with his business, of course, and that's gone.
Right.
Because the sons took it over. So he's got the money left over, but he doesn't really have the happiness that he once had. This is terrible, Ben. In 1999, October of 1999, Leonard Schoen committed suicide by car. He crashed his own car and they deemed it a suicide. I think it was in Las Vegas, Nevada. He was 83 years old at the time.
Yeah.
But man, what a tragic end to this empire for this guy. Now the empire, of course, carries on with these sons, but these are the ones that overtook the company from the father, and this is the whole start of this tragic downfall of the patriarch.
Yeah, and Leonard himself was 83 at the time mm-hmm. of his passing. This remains a strange and ongoing story. Now, again, I think we've been pretty. We're doing a just the facts thing. I'm not speculating on any of this, just saying what the courts have said and what the various family members have said, but it is quite possible that we will not know the full story, really.
Yeah, that's possible.
But this is the thing that we did not expect to discover when we were covering U-Haul, but there is more to come, right?
Yeah, and it's not all good news either. I mean, there's some safety issues that we'd like to talk
uh-huh.
about. There's also, I guess the current state of things, and I want to talk a little bit about. I have a question for you at the end of this, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. But we've got something that we'd like to do first, right?
Yeah, it's time for a word from our sponsor.
All right, so we're back, and you know, as promised, we're going to get into some of the safety issues and where things stand right now and maybe my question too, but a couple of little things that I found along the way that I thought were kind of interesting that I think we should talk about also, and we didn't even talk about this off air or anything, so I'm kind of hitting you with this, but did you know that all U-Haul trucks have Arizona license plates? The ones that they do not expire, they never expire, these Arizona plates on U-Haul trucks. And it's not every single one. There's a couple of exceptions. Newer trailers in the U-Haul fleet that have apportioned plates that are registered in other states, and then Alaska and Hawaii markets, which, you know, they also have their own registration systems. But outside of those, you know, the few exceptions, all of the other trucks have Arizona plates. I've never noticed that, but you can believe that I'm going to look for that today on the road as I drive home.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I didn't know that.
I thought it was. And then the other thing that I didn't know, and this this will maybe not surprise any Ford Explorer owners. This is a ban on Ford Explorers that goes back, it goes back to 2003,
mm-hmm.
Where they said that because of, you know, all the problems that were going on with Ford, the Ford Explorer and the Firestone tires, the issue, the rollovers.
Yeah.
They claim, and I'll read this so it all makes sense, but they claim it wasn't really involved. It's just happened to be under the same time frame. But if you had a Ford Explorer that was model year 2010 or older, you were unable to rent a U-Haul trailer to tow behind that vehicle. They wouldn't rent to you.
Why?
Because they said that according to U-Haul, U-Haul has chosen not to rent behind this tow vehicle based on our history of excessive costs and defending lawsuits involving Ford Explorer towing combinations.
Huh.
This policy does not involve safety issues. This is an unusual circumstance for U-Haul. So I think they're tying it into the whole rollover Firestone tire thing that was going on back in the mid 2000s, I think.
Yeah,
it was, right?
Yeah. I remember
and
that.
As of mid 2013, however, U-Haul will rent trailers to Ford Explorers that are 2011 model year or newer. So the Explorer line is still around. You can still get a U-Haul trailer if you have a vehicle that is newer than 2011. And here's another little interesting bit on this thing. I thought.
What's that?
Okay, so the Ford rollover controversy, I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, it really was. There were like 240 deaths. There were 3,000 catastrophic injuries as a result of the rollover situation. And Ford eventually decided to replace, I think it was, I'm just drawing from my memory here, I think it was 13 million Firestone tires that they replaced on Ford Explorer trucks, after that
wow.
lawsuit had happened. So, big deal there. And here's the thing, U-Haul did not alter the policy of renting to owners of similar vehicles like the Mercury Mountaineer, the Mazda Navajo, and then early versions of the Lincoln Aviator,
mm-hmm.
all which were mechanically identical to the Explorer. They simply singled out the Explorer, and I find that unusual. They would still rent to the other makes, I guess,
yeah.
within the Ford umbrella of companies, of brands.
I guess it must have just been a calculation of how often this particular or an individual make of a car shows up, right?
I guess so. And, you know, the thing is that they said regardless of the tire brand that's attached to this vehicle, the idea that we're not going to rent to these people comes from many accidents involving Bridgestone or Firestone tires. And I'd like to add this because I read it somewhere on a U-Haul site or something. And they had reports that the rear bumper would separate from the vehicle, taking the tow hook assembly with it. That would be troublesome, I would guess, for somebody
right.
who's renting a trailer to you.
But at the same, like, while we're talking about it, safety, this is interesting because around the same time, the 2000s,
mm-hmm.
The Toronto Star mm-hmm. and the Ministry of Transportation in Canada both had these publications about safety issues with U-Haul.
Yeah.
They had
an investigative report.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they said that that of the 296 U-Haul vehicles they investigated, or inspected rather, about 19, a little bit less than 20% were found to have out of service defects, meaning that they weren't usable on the road.
They're not roadworthy?
Yeah, that's what they were saying.
Oh my gosh. That's a huge number. Now, I know that a lot of these trucks failed individual tests as well, as far as like, you know, they would have things like brakes that were far too worn down.
Right.
They would have maybe mechanical components that weren't completely, buttoned up the way that they should be.
Transmission issues.
Yeah, transmission issues, things like that. So there were some serious safety problems. And digging into this, I started to read some of these articles, and there's no way we can cover them today because they're very lengthy. As you would expect them to be. But,
right.
There's some articles that this article points to and says, going back to about 2000, 2006, 2007, there's a couple of articles I'd like to point you to. The one's called Driving with Rented Risks. And then there's Upkeep Lags in U-Haul's Aging Fleet. And then, here's an interesting one. Key Trial Evidence Goes Missing. And I will tell you what that one is about because that sounds really intriguing.
Right.
Only briefly though. It was something to do with a defective tire and rim from a trailer that was involved in an accident and then involved in a court case. And I believe that U-Haul reconditioned the tire and rim and put it back on a vehicle or held it and fixed it in some way. So that was kind of the angle that now did they or did they not do that? I can't say. I mean, you have to read the court transcripts and find out exactly what happened in that trial to really get the understanding. But here's my thing with this maintenance issue.
Okay.
It's not excusable ever, really. I mean, if you're going to have a company that rents products like this, it's not excusable to have unsafe materials out on the road, unsafe things for people to rent, because they don't know. They're just there they're on Saturday to pick it up. They're going to return it Saturday night or Sunday.
Yeah.
They don't know. It is, however, and I want to be careful about this. It's understandable when you look at the size and the scope of U-Haul as a company that some things slip through the cracks like this. Now, it should never happen. There should be systems in place. I get that.
Sure.
But when I think I read something that said, okay, well, this one vehicle that was involved in this this one accident, and they were going to investigate. He said the guy that was in charge of that particular unit, or tracking that unit, or whatever, had said, well, since that time, we've rented that one trailer 19 times, and this is like, you know, not even a month later,
right?
So it's like a daily rental thing. So it is difficult for them to schedule that, but I do think that you know, trucks, trailers. All the stuff, all the equipment that they rent, all that. I mean, there should be a regular maintenance routine.
Right, yeah.
But who's in charge of making sure that happens?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, man, but I've got to talk about this one thing. You can go to a website called uhaulsafetyalert.org, and that points to some disturbing observations / allegations. They say that U-Haul doesn't automatically retire vehicles after a certain threshold of age or mileage. Mm-hmm. So that means you could get something that has 200K plus on it.
So you jump in on a weekend and you're going to head down through the mountains or something, and you realize that the truck has 200,000 miles on it. But you wouldn't know this. You would know the mileage, but you wouldn't know the last time the brakes were serviced.
Right.
You wouldn't know how many miles that transmission has on it. When you're climbing a mountain with everything that you own in the back of the truck, you know, it could be a difficult climb. You know, it gets pretty steep in some places.
Sure, the grade.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, is it going to hold up? Is it going
to
work?
Well, here's another question, though, because I do have to say, in their defense, it may just be part of the reason that they seem like they have these continual battles with the safety stuff, may be down to the franchisees and what their responsibility is. I can't really speak too much about it, but I think we should be hesitant to paint in broad brush strokes like the Schoen family. I mean, ultimately, it is their company, so ultimately it does go down to them.
Absolutely, and I feel that way. And I want to stress this, that I want to say it's not excusable, but I understand how it happens. I understand that, you know, things slip through like that. I mean, or the franchisees aren't keeping up with their end of the bargain, that they were supposed to do that. Or someone misreads the number on a trailer, and then that one should have had the trailer brakes inspected, but it didn't. It went out. And we'll catch the next one that comes in. But maybe there's another system. Maybe they put out an alert to where that trailer is going to, that it does get service next time, even if it wasn't scheduled there to get the service.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's got to be a check and balance on this thing that, you know, and I'm sure that there's something like that there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're just not using it correctly. And this, again, not to paint a bad picture of this whole company.
Right.
Because I've rented U-Haul vehicles before. I've rented Ryder trucks before. I've rented Penske trucks before. And you know, trailers and car haulers and things like that. And honestly, I've never had a problem with any of the equipment.
Yeah, there's another thing that I should point out. In my personal life, every time I have moved in this country, I have used a U-Haul truck at some point.
Really?
Yeah.
Every time?
Every time. Even if it's just one of, you know, the smaller ones.
Yeah.
But it's always been a truck. I never hooked a trailer up.
Okay. So box truck.
Yeah, just a box truck.
Okay, with the little mom's attic section above the cab there, and the super graphics on the side. We didn't even talk about super graphics, which is, you know, it's kind of a fluffy thing to talk about, but it's interesting.
But I think, unfortunately, we're running a little low on time here, Mr. B.
So how about one more thing?
Yes.
And this is just, maybe just put it out there to everybody, but here's my one more thing.
One more thing.
All right, so here's the big question that I want to ask you and I want to ask the listeners.
All right.
All right, so sure, it's legal and everything to rent a 26-foot truck, which, by the way, is just the size of the box on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the, I don't know, what do you say, 10 feet of cab maybe on the front of that?
That's fair.
That's 36 feet.
Sure.
Then you've got a tow hitch on the back of that, and then you can rent a trailer that can haul your car on the back of that. So what's that length? Maybe 15 feet?
Mm-hmm.
So you got 26 plus 10, that's 36 plus 15. What's that total? It's 51 feet. Is that right?
It's a lot of truck.
I think that's 51 feet. Maybe even a little bit longer because you got the tongue on the trailer. So let's ballpark this.
Okay.
60 feet. You're suddenly driving a 60-foot truck when you don't have a CDL license or anything like that. The 26-foot truck is you're allowed to use that with just a regular operator's license.
Or possibly no experience driving these whatsoever.
And I know this because that's how I moved here to Georgia. I had a 26-foot box truck and a trailer that hauled my Honda on it, my Civic Si.
Yeah, you had the Civic at
the time. And it had this giant trailer on the back end. And there I am. I got to drive from Michigan to Atlanta. And I don't really have an experience driving a 60-foot truck with a trailer. I mean, if I had to back that thing up, I was in huge trouble. So stops for me became so problematic along the way. Like when I was looking for a gas station, I was sweating, thinking I've got to find somewhere I can pull through. That even if I exit and I don't see something, I've got to find a way to somehow snake my way around that I don't have to back this thing out of here because I can't do it. I'm not experienced with it. Other people could do it with ease. But it's a huge, huge vehicle. It's a big undertaking when it's something you've never done before. And you're dealing with all kinds of things like trailer brakes. You're dealing with, a speed limited vehicle. You're dealing with a vehicle that who knows how much that thing weighed when I had it fully weighted with everything from my house to my car.
And if it's not loaded right, I'm sure you loaded it correctly. But if the load is unevenly distributed, it can be very dangerous.
Yeah, and I'm driving through the mountains. And it's nighttime and I'm driving through the mountains and it wasn't raining or anything like that or snowing.
Goodness.
But what if it was snowing and I did that? And, here's the thing. It's like, okay, so it's legal, but is this a good idea? Is it a good idea to really rent 60 feet of vehicle with a trailer to somebody who's unaccustomed to doing that? I mean, they may ask you when you do it, have you ever driven something like this? And they may tell you that you're not supposed to back the trailer up. But let's be real. When you pull off, into a gas station, there are times when you're going to have to kind of, work that thing back and forth to get it in and out of the, out of the gas station. It's difficult. And it's something that, I've thought about this many times when I see a rental truck like this, whether it's Penske, because mine was a Penske.
Okay.
That I rented on the way down. No problems at all, by the way. It was flawless, but as far as the equipment goes, there were some stories that go along with this, like where I was stuck, but I'll tell you about those some other day. But the thing is, like when you see a rental truck like that on the road, I tend to give those people a little more buffer zone now than I ever did in the past prior to my move.
Absolutely.
Because I know that half the time those people just are inexperienced. They don't really know what to expect out of that truck because they may have only been driving it for 30 minutes at that point.
Right. And they're not comfortable either. I know something about driving, I think can make us all pretty self-centered people.
Yeah.
You and I have talked about it before, how lucky we are that people don't walk the way they drive.
Yeah.
You know
definitely.
What I mean? But the thing that I give people wide berth for whenever I see one of those box trucks driving is I do assume they are probably moving, right?
Mm-hmm.
I assume that they probably don't drive a truck that size that often because the number of people with a CDL versus the number of people renting U-Haul trucks is not near 1-to-1.
Yeah. I mean, you jump out of your Toyota Corolla and into that. It's a huge learning curve.
So for me, it's almost a courtesy. And I know a lot of people don't believe in being courteous to others on the road. So call me old fashioned. But if I see someone who is like clearly a college student, maybe just driving for the first time or anyone really, then what I'm trying to do is maintain a safe distance more so because I know they're probably already very nervous. If they're smart, they should be. And I have a story for you that answers this.
Perfect.
Oh, okay. Well, so one day, where was I living? I was living down east of town or something. And, I was getting on Interstate 20 and Scott, I was pissed because I was running late. I think it might have been for this podcast. I can't remember, but this is several years ago.
Yeah.
And, I'm at this turn where just for anyone who hasn't been to Atlanta, a lot of Interstate 20 is just poorly designed. And, there are some death trap moments there too. But this was just a bad intersection to get from a surface street to the interstate. And I was behind. a U-Haul driver, and this was before I was considerate of these drivers. You know, it's just like you were just in my way.
Yeah.
I was behind this U-Haul driver, not in a very big truck, just a box, and they were driving crazy. They were swerving. They were, they were swerving. They were stopping at weird moments.
Mm-hmm. Unnecessary braking, that kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah. Which now, in retrospect, says that driver was probably just nervous.
Yeah, probably.
Given the time of day.
Mm-hmm.
And so me, being a jerk at this point, I get over in the right lane, pass him, gun it, click back in the left lane, getting toward where we would turn to get on the interstate. And then I'm getting freaked out because this person did one of those things. Have you ever been driving and someone's going super slow and so you go around them and all of a sudden they find out where their accelerator is? Because this U-Haul driver must have resented me or something.
Yeah.
And, or maybe it was just stressed out. I don't know. I don't even remember seeing the guy's face because, as we were driving, I took the turn and they were going too fast. And they took the turn, way harder, and they must not have had, the load distributed correctly. 'Cause that thing, man, it just fell to the right.
No kidding.
Yeah,
it just fell.
It did. It just fell to its side. It didn't completely flip. It just fell and bounced.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
It's like, over, call 911, cops are out. The person is fine.
Yeah.
The dude is fine. It's not injured, but
it makes you wonder if something else is going on there. I mean, it sounds like very erratic driving. I wonder.
But
the point is that you just never know what the situation is, and the people are going to be stressed. The people are going to be because it's moving day, likely. They're brand new to it, so they're inexperienced. So
right.
You combine that alone. I mean, it's just you have limited visibility compared to your car, which I know if you drive a pickup truck with a load in the back or something on the back,
right.
you're accustomed to using your mirrors more, but. Most people aren't. Most people are, accustomed to turning their head to back up.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there's so many things about it that I feel like it's rough on everybody else around that person when they're on the road because
right.
You never know what their situation is. And I'm really cautious about it now. I'm very, very careful around any of those rental trucks.
Yeah.
I just assume that they have no experience because I know that I didn't. I mean, I was able to, after a while, you get the hang of it. You get the feel of it and you can. You do much better. You stay in your lane better.
Mm-hmm.
You know the right way to approach a turn and the speeds. And
you
all
get
that.
In the zone.
Yeah, you do.
Well, let's end on a positive note. I will say one thing that is just astonishing and kind of beautiful that to live in a place where you can go to a gas station, get a truck, throw your stuff in it, and then just drive off into the sunset.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Never look back if you don't want to.
Never look back if you don't want to. I mean, you have to use the rear view at some point or the side mirrors, but that is a cool thing. And this may be the longest single episode that Car Stuff has ever done. And we hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed making it because we didn't even get to everything.
Yeah, that's right.
We're having so much fun with this.
So Austin, I mean, you said there's not much to say about U-Haul, but honestly, like the family story makes this so intriguing and so, so complex that we just had to go on a long, I guess, is it a rant? I don't know if it's a rant.
An exploration.
An exploration of the family and the company. But the company itself is fascinating. The family also fascinating.
Yeah.
You combine the two together, it makes for a good story.
And, of course, we hope that there is a a beneficial resolution to this. U-Haul is something that a lot of people in the States have encountered. So let us know your U-Haul experiences. Did they ever give you a car that was unsafe to drive? Did you have a great experience? Did you ever used to work for U-Haul? How do you react when you see someone who clearly doesn't know how to drive a truck on the road? Especially because I bet our trucker friends, I bet you guys see this all the time. So find us on Facebook and Twitter. You guys know the drill by now. We're CarStuffHSW. If you want to email those stories to us directly and take a page from Austin's book, then we'd love to hear from you. Our address is
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.